This season of the Outdoor Life podcast is brought to you by Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro.
If you're a deer hunter, you're going to see a lot of content over the next few weeks about hunting the whitetail rut. Now, most of this content is going to focus on buck behavior and how to anticipate it. You're going to hear a lot about cold fronts and barometric pressure. You might hear some talk about moon phases. You're definitely going to hear about timing of the rut and its subsequent stages. But if you are a public land deer hunter, or if you hunt small size private ground, all of these factors are much less important than the single biggest factor that dictates when and where bucks move, and that is hunting pressure. I'm Editor-in-Chief Alex Robinson, and I am a private land deer hunter. So, in order to better understand how hunting pressure impacts whitetail rutting behavior, I'm talking to Aaron Warbritton of The Hunting Public. Aaron and his crew travel all around the country each fall to deer hunt on public lands and on some private ground they're able to get permission on. These guys have seen firsthand how deer react to hunting pressure. They've gotten good at anticipating hunter behavior, and they've also learned how to work around other hunters to still find success. Here's a sneak peek at one of the things they've learned. Their favorite time to hunt? It's the last week of October. Not the heart of the rut in November. Now, here are some other secrets Aaron has to share.
Hey, Aaron, thanks for joining us on the podcast. I know this is a really busy time of year, and you guys are out hunting all over the country usually.
No problem, man. Happy to do it.
Yeah, I want to talk to you specifically because I have to admit, I do almost all of my deer hunting on private land, and most of the Outdoor Life editors and writers also do a lot of their deer hunting on private land. So a lot of the content that we're getting in specifically about hunting deer during the rut is kind of based on experiences that people are having with private land deer. And I'm curious to hear from you. In your experience, is whitetail deer rutting behavior different on public land?
I would say it's different on pressured land. If you've got, and the reason why I make say pressured is because private land can be pressured. Public land cannot be pressured. I know that most people associate public land hunting with, you know, high pressure hunting situations for the most part. And it is. Most generally, but there's definitely exceptions in the same way there is with private land. So on private land where you're the sole person that has access to a large piece of ground, say 400 or 500 acres, and you can manipulate the habitat and things, that's low pressure. But if you are knocking on doors and you've got permission to hunt on a farmer's ground and down the road that's got a couple hundred acres and five other people in the neighborhood also do, then that could be moderate pressure, you know. So I associate it all with, as far as deer behavior, specifically rutting behavior, I would associate it all with hunting pressure. And it does negatively impact how much movement that you'll see. A good example of that, I guess, would be, you know, in Iowa, the first week in November gets talked up a lot across all sorts of outdoor media, you know, November 3rd through the 7th. And that's an awesome time to be in the woods, especially if you're on a piece of private ground or a piece of public land that's not getting pressure. The rub there is, though, on public land, that's when the majority of the hunters take their vacation. So, yes, the deer are starting to rut, but they're also at the same time experiencing this giant influx of people that they have not seen for months and months and months on end. Mm-hmm. And they're all piling into the woods, taking their, you know, rut vacation in early November. And they're out there all day because, you know, most folks, they get a week or two's worth of hunting vacation and they're going to spend it in the woods for the most part. So, you know, you may be looking at a 400 or 500 acre tract that had just a few people hunting it up until the rut hit in early November, and then boom, all of a sudden there's 4 or 5 trucks at every parking lot and there's, you know, 15 to 20 people hunting that tract or more. in a given day. And that's going to move deer around. And that's going to, they're still going to rut, and they're, because, you know, rut is a timing thing. Right. They're going to do their thing, but they're going to change the places in which they do it, and they'll condense their movements down to just really thick, secure areas where they feel safe. Once they find a place where they feel safe, they'll carry on with the rut. But I definitely see deer get moved around a lot during that time.
So on these kind of moderately pressured or pressured public lands, in your experience, are deer kind of like finding little pockets within those tracks? Or are they just getting blown out and they're gone, and now they're on some big private land or some sanctuary, you know, a state park that you can't hunt or something like that?
Both. Most of the time, though, it's a little pocket here or there that they just move to where no people are at. I mean, it's really that simple. They are just so good at finding the place where there's no human scent and where there's no human presence. And they can do that within a matter of days. I mean, even less than that. When the gun season comes in Iowa, that first weekend, that first Saturday, the opening day of gun season, they might be in the same areas where you found them prior, but by the following day, in a lot of those spots, the deer have completely changed. They've moved out of those areas. They got ran out. They moved. They sensed the pressure, and now they're in thick little pockets on the landscape, or even overlook little pockets next to the road that people just aren't going into. That's why we're always talking about mobile hunting tactics during the rut. I mean, if I go to an area that in the 1st of November at the beginning of the rut that's getting pounded with pressure, I may not even go out and hunt first thing. I'll just drive around and look for trucks and look for people. And then when I find a place where there's no people, I'll go in there, and sometimes it's a complete rut frenzy in there. I mean, even more so than you would think in other situations, because there's a secure area there that all the deer in the surrounding area are in effect pushed into. And like I said, once they find that safety zone, they go right back to doing their thing. They go right back to that rutting behavior. So if you're in one of those spots where there's no people and you're getting bucks pushed to you essentially, and does that may be coming into heat, it can be just ridiculous action. But that's been our experience in the rut, especially on pressured land, is it's very hot or cold.
And now, you know, if you've got a big public land track that you like, and you've scouted some stuff and you kind of have a good idea of where you like to hunt, or where you would like to hunt based on, you know, sign and previous deer sightings, and just kind of like a good feeling of like, oh, this is a good rut funnel, or I really like hunting around this bedding area or whatever. And you go in there and you see that there's a bunch of trucks in the parking lot to get to that spot, and you've got a good feeling that there's going to be a bunch of people hunting it. Would you rather go into a spot cold where there's nobody?
Yep.
Yeah. So like of all the factors that you kind of consider during a public land deer hunt. So, you know, everything from temperature, you know, wind, moon phase, if you pay attention to that, you know, all the different things that you can decide on where to hunt from. Do you rank hunting pressure at the top of that list?
Yes, I would.
Yeah. So you're kind of scouting the hunters first and then going from there.
Yep. And especially in early season, and then the pre-rut leading up to probably around, you know, in our area, the Midwest, probably between the 5th and the 10th, leading up to that time frame, we are hunting those weather fronts really hard. Just like most people, you know, I mean, most folks have heard, you know, all of the talk out there about cold fronts the last few years. Those are awesome to hunt, but that all gets trumped in my experience if there's a bunch of people in there. Now, if there's people that are just showing up today to hunt the cold front, then it doesn't impact my decision-making as much, I would say. But if there's been people in there for several days on end, like if I go by a parking area and I see two or three hunters going one direction every day for 3 or 4 days, or multiple times over the course of a week, I'll write that area off. I mean, I might still hunt, you know, close to that parking lot, but I'm more than likely not going to walk down the access path that all those people are on. And unless I'm going to go way to the back somewhere, basically until I stop seeing boot tracks or people sign.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, weather is definitely important, but hunting pressure, number one.
Gotcha. And I imagine that over the years, you're kind of able to anticipate where this pressure is going to happen just by, you know, kind of looking at the access and looking at how the properties or the public property set up, right? Like there's stuff that looks really attractive and is really easy access, and that's going to attract other hunters, right?
Yes, it will. And we don't necessarily avoid those areas, but you know, that those are definitely the spots that are going to attract the most people. But the reason why I say that we don't necessarily avoid it is because those areas can be really efficient to scout. You know, if you pull up to a parking lot and there's a trail going back in the woods for a mile and a half, that trail's really easy to walk down and to look for sign on. And most of the time we're anticipating there not to be deer bedded right on top of that access trail because there's people on it all the time.
Right.
However, you know, if you're hunting a big public area and there's 20 of those access trails there and there's people parked at 18 of them, we might hunt one of the other two.
Right.
You know, and not hunt far off the path. It kind of just depends on what the sign is telling us, because deer move around so much throughout the fall, you know, especially, you know, as acorn crop changes and other types of browse become available, maple leaves, you know, all kinds of stuff, locust pods in our area, you know, what's the other one that we look at quite a bit? Osage, orange tree.
Okay.
Yeah. Hedge balls, hedge trees. When they drop their leaves in late October after a frost or two, deer will just hammer those things for a couple of days. So where I'm going with this is that the whitetail's behavior is changing almost, you know, on a weekly basis throughout the fall. And if a hot food source pops up for them right next to an access, they may just move in there. So maybe it was getting hunting pressure a ton 2 weeks ago. Then the people fell off because there was no more deer in there. Then all of a sudden a food source changes and a week or two later, there's deer in there. Well, that's why we'll walk those access paths sometimes, is just to cover more ground and try to understand what's going on in that particular area more efficiently. But yeah, back to your point, I mean, that's, people are going to take the path of least resistance most of the time.
Right.
And they're going to choose to park in a lot and then walk a path in.
We'll be right back after the break.
This season of the Outdoor Life podcast is brought to you by Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro. This is one of the most advanced and smartest wireless trail cameras. The Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro automatically finds and connects to the strongest cell signal in your area, no matter the carrier. Plus, no more SD cards. Even better, it eliminates false triggered images with AI technology built directly into the camera. This allows its smart capture technology to send only the images you want. If buck images are what you want, then buck images are what you get. It also incorporates smart zone tech, allowing you to turn off custom zones where tree limbs or tall grass cause your camera to take endless photos of nothing, which rob your camera of battery life and fills your gallery with junk images. It has the easiest activation and setup of any cell camera on the market, and it sends HD video and images to your cell phone via the Moultrie mobile app. This is the most feature-rich app available, and it will enhance your scouting and hunting experience. The Edge Pro sells for $179.99 nationwide or at MoultrieMobile.com.
Talk to me about the mobile hunting strategy. I really like this concept, whether you're on private or public land. But one of the thing, like one of my hangups with it is like, I'm always nervous about just like cropping into an area and blowing up the spot that I would have wanted to hunt, but just like not quite recognizing that quickly enough. So how do you balance that? Like, all right, we got to kind of be aggressive here and find the spot where we want to hunt, but we don't want to just like blow through the woods and blow it up and actually burn spots that we would have been hunting by kind of overly aggressively scouting them?
I try to maximize the conditions that we have on any given day to either assist in access or scouting.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, take today, for example, where I'm at here in Missouri right now, it's warm. It's like in the 80s today. Deer movement's going to be pretty poor tonight, I would assume. But yeah. It's in the 80s today, and there's a strong south wind, and it's blowing, 15, 20 miles an hour. Right now is the time that I would pick to aggressively scout into the wind. So if I had any ridge systems or creek bottoms or whatever that I wanted to look through that basically set up well for me to come from the north and work my way into the wind, that's what I would be doing right now if I was going into a new area. I'd be spending the middle part of the day going into the wind, even though it's hot. I don't really have plans of hunting, but what I'm wanting to do is learn that area and figure out how I can access in and out of there without booger and deer. And as I'm going into the wind, with a 15, 20 mile an hour wind, I'm going to spook way fewer deer because I'm not making as much noise. They're bedded right now. I'm scouting into the wind. So ideally any deer that I do bump are not smelling me. They're just either seeing me and I'm catching them off guard. They're bounding off and they're going just to the next available bedding area. 9 times out of 10, they're holding up right there. So yeah. It's not like a gun season pressure where you take 10 guys and try to push deer to another 10 guys and you're just flinging lead all over the place. That type of pressure will send deer packing. But the type that I'm talking about is aggressive, but what I've found is, man, if they don't smell you and you just startle them a little bit as you're slipping through the woods into the wind, it's really not a big deal. And I'm constantly looking for ways to get in and out. That's the other part of that question, I guess, that I would answer is the access portion.
Yeah.
You're doing that scouting so that you can understand your access in there, especially for a morning hunt in the dark or for an evening hunt exit strategy to get out. You want to be able to look at a dry creek bed, for example. If you think on a map that looks like a potentially good access route to get in to a deer's bedding area in the morning without blowing the whole deal, then you need to know if you can get down that creek or not. That's a mistake that we used to make a lot, and we would get into mess all the time because we would just look at a creek system. We'd be like, okay, we'll just access in there in the morning. Then we would go in blind in the dark, and we did kill some bucks that way, but it can be rough going in the dark into country that you're not familiar with. It's just way easier to creep in there middle of the day into the day wind and look at that stuff with the intentions of hunting it again in a few days.
If you're on one of those daytime scouting missions like today, it's hot, windy, you're going and you bump a nice deer, a nice buck, that doesn't bum you out. Like you're
no
that's not hurting your chances in your experience.
Yeah, and I'm certain that there's situations where you obviously would not want to do that. If you're hunting a 100-acre private piece of ground, sure, and you're scouting towards the back edge of it where there's a known bedding area, you don't want to go and blow that buck out of that thing,
right?
Because he's on your private ground right now. But right. If you're hunting a piece of public land that's 2,000 acres in size and you're combing through bedding areas in the center of it into the wind, that deer's most likely going to see or hear you bound off over the ridge and go to the next available cover because it's in the middle of the day. He doesn't want to make any big moves in the middle of the day. He just wants to get away from whatever that danger was and go to the next available secure space. And that's what we see 9 times out of 10 with big bucks or does or little bucks or whatever. If we bump into them, it's just like, okay, stop, kneel down, get down on the ground, try to get out of sight as quick as you can. Don't push the issue. Watch the direction that they went and then avoid that area. It's like you don't want to bump them twice, but if you do bump them, sometimes that's the best thing that can happen because it tells me that there's a big one in there,
right,
that I want to hunt. And then he went a specific direction. Well, he must be comfortable, escaping towards cover in that direction. I mean, Ted did that. We've killed multiple bucks doing that, where we bump them and then we kill them either later that day. But what more often happens is we bump them on a day like today, windy, midday, and then we kill them in the next 2 or 3 days. And often we're killing them within 200 or 300 yards of where we bumped them. Ted did that just last week. He didn't kill the buck, but it was October 2nd, I think, in Iowa, and it was like 90 degrees. He was scouting a dry creek bed, real quiet, middle of the day, going into the wind, and he jumped a buck from like 10 feet away from him, who was bedded in the edge of that creek. Buck ran off maybe 30 yards. It's a video that's up on our channel right now, I think. Buck ran off like 10 yards away, stopped in the creek and turned back to look at him, but Ted had already hit the deck and was, you know, hid in some weeds. So yeah, he just filmed the buck, stare at him. Stare his direction for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And eventually the buck just eased off. I mean, he kind of jogs off and then bounds up on top of the creek and then walks back towards the more secure bedding area. But he was walking within 15 minutes of that, and he was only 100 yards from that spot. Ted just startled him because the buck did not expect somebody to be there.
Right.
You know, at that time, he just startled the deer, and then he went off into the bedding area. And I think like 3 or 4 days later, Ted was hunting the bedding area that the deer went into, and he saw him. So like, he didn't spook him. This is a area that's 150 acres in size, maybe. And he saw him within 200 or 300 yards where he bumped him.
Gotcha. Yeah. So like a key part of this is just kind of being able to read that deer's behavior during, like, when you bump him, right? Like, this buck obviously was startled, but not even necessarily spooked. He's just kind of like moved off of his core spot a little bit, but not even really sure what he's running from.
Right. It's reading the situation. Every one of them is slightly different. And you can certainly bump a buck by sight or sound and force him to leave the area. Like, they'll take out of there like a bat out of hell and get out of Dodge completely, and you won't see him again. But that's rare. When they smell you, they got you.
Yeah.
And sometimes even that's why the body language thing can be a little tricky, because I've been smelled by deer that stood there and blew and stomped and kind of eased off, walked off, but they 100% smelled me, and I did not see them anymore. But I would have based their body language off of, well, he just eased out of here, you know, but I never saw him again after that. I think what they're doing is they're just, those big bucks, they rely so much on their nose for everything. They're picking that scent apart. And sometimes it takes them minutes to do that, you know, standing there and smelling over and over again. I mean, they're figuring out exactly where you're at, all that stuff. And then they're sneaking out of there, and they're not coming back to that area because they smelled you. They know that that's dangerous. However, if they just see you, they just don't seem to equate the same amount of danger to it. They're like, it's just not as big of a threat for whatever reason as whenever they smell you. I mean, when you think about it, though, they probably get bumped out of bed sometimes from coyotes or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a bobcat's crawling in through the thick area and one crawls up to 6-7 feet from them and they take off.
Right.
That's not going to mean they're never going to use that bedding area again. That just means that they're probably not going to use it again for a few hours. And then they may go right back to what they're doing.
Yeah. Someone, I can't remember who wrote this, but someone kind of equated it to, like, you know, if you or I smell, say, gasoline somewhere in our house, but it's kind of faint, and we're not really sure what the problem is, but we know there's a problem, right? We shouldn't smell gasoline in our house. But now, say, on the flip side, you go into your bedroom and you were just hit with a powerful wave of gasoline that just, you know, makes your eyes water. Like, that's going to trigger some like serious alarm in you. And the writer kind of put it that way. Like, if a buck gets that real good whiff, that real good smell of your scent in his bedding area, that's going to trigger kind of like the highest alarm. Is that kind of how you were seeing it too?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like they're in those bedding areas because we aren't.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best explanation I can give to it. And when they smell that you're in, and when they encounter human scent in there, like actively in there, they do not like it. Sometimes ground scent can booger them up. Like if you go gomming through a bedding area and you don't manage to spook a buck out of it, but you leave your ground scent all over it, that's a negative thing for them. But it's much more negative if you're going into a bedding area with a questionable wind and you're blowing your scent in there. I think a lot of times we don't even, when that happens, the person that's scouting doesn't even see the deer spook because they've already smelled them and they're gone.
Right. Right.
And then that's the worst outcome you could want, because they smelled them. Like we said, that's the worst thing, but also you don't even know what's in there cause you didn't get a look at it or not.
Right. Right.
So you have no idea what even happened. And then, you know, you're dealing with a buck that's on your trail camera on the other side of the property at 1 a.m. and you're calling him nocturnal. Well, I mean, that's because you don't know where he's at right now. And you're basically giving him free moves in the game when you do that.
Yeah. Talk to me about the nocturnal bucks like that. That is something that I think so many hunters just have trouble with. Is like, we all love using trail cameras. It's just fun to get trail camera pictures. They obviously help us. But if we're just getting, you know, a lot of nighttime pictures of the deer we're trying to shoot and just calling them nocturnal, is there kind of an issue with that, do you think? Or do you think most of the time those deer really are nocturnal?
No, I think almost in every instance, they're not nocturnal.
Yeah.
They move, you know, that's the thing is a lot of people have different interpretations of it whenever you talk about nocturnal bucks. Right. But the way I think about it, it is if a buck is nocturnal, that means he only moves at night. He does not move during the day.
Yes.
And I think that is false.
Yeah.
And there's quite a bit of science out there right now from the, you know, MSU deer lab that shows that it's false. The bucks are still moving during the day. Yeah. They just may not move very far, and they may move in a very specific confined area, but they're not laying in their beds until an hour after dark. And then they're back in their bed an hour before daylight. And then they sit there in the same spot literally all day long.
Right.
So they'll get up and get a drink or browse on some stuff nearby or whatever. They may only make it within 100-yard circle during the daylight. And when you really think about that, like if you're dealing with a couple hundred acre property and the buck that you're after is only going to move within an 80 to 100-yard circle during the day, all day, during legal shooting hours, what are the odds of you getting a daylight trail camera photo of him?
Very low.
Very low. Yeah. Unless you just happen to have that camera right on the edge of that area that he feels comfortable moving in.
That's
and
right.
Cold fronts can change that. You know, that can get bucks up and moving further. And then obviously the rut, if you've got nothing but nighttime trail camera pictures of a buck in the middle of the night all month October, and you can only hunt them on the property that the camera's on, like you don't have a lot of moves to move closer to a bedding area, I think, you know, that first week of the rut into the middle of the rut is a good time to kill that one.
Yeah.
Because he's obviously working his way through that area. He's interested in something that's there, either food or does or likely both. And he'll revisit that often during the rut when he's making his rut loops. But that's not where he's at right now. Like if you got a cell camera and you get pictures of a buck at 2 a.m., well, you know, I wouldn't be hunting anywhere close to that camera the next time I went out.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to go and sit up there at 2 p.m. and hope that he comes in before sunset. Yeah.
No, I mean, he could be a half mile from there bedded and living during the day. He could be 300 yards from there. I don't really know, but I just know if he's there in the middle of the night, the odds are pretty slim that he's going to be there during the day.
Right. So if you get a scenario like that on public land, what are you doing?
We'll often set up trail cameras real close to accesses, you know, along field edges or whatever, where there's scrapes, and everybody and their dog is seeing these scrapes because they're walking past them. Sure. It's easy access, but we'll still put a camera there, and we'll often catch the buck that's making that scrape run that thing at 3-4 in the morning, and then we'll backtrack him into the bedding area.
Yeah, that's when you use your digital mapping and scouting to try to anticipate where he's bedding.
Yep. And sometimes, like I said, it's within a couple hundred yards. Others, it's half to 3/4 of a mile away. Kind of just depends on all the other dynamics involved with that particular situation. But we'll still try and hunt those deer that we're getting nighttime pictures of. We just are not hunting them anywhere close to that camera. Right. Or we're going about getting in and out of there a completely different way than we would, you know, if we were checking that camera. But like I said, as a caveat a minute ago, I've run those cameras all month of September, October, November, and only gotten daylight photos on like Halloween or November 7th or November 11th or November 18th. And people are like, well, you know, that buck was only active during the day one day. No, he was only active during the day in front of your camera that one day during the rut.
Right.
You know,
that's right. Yeah.
The rest of the time he was still active. He just was not active right there. He was, right. He was choosing to live in a different spot.
Right. You know, we were talking earlier about this first week in November, but then you just mentioned Halloween, which is, this is kind of something that I see kind of some more folks talk about, and also something that I have kind of experienced, but just haven't really written about. But is that last week of October, maybe in some ways, kind of more productive for hunting the rut in your experience?
I like it better. And I would say as a group, we would all, if we had to take the last week of October or the first week of November, I think pretty much everybody unanimously would pick the last week of October. But yeah. I think it's more a function of a lack of pressure. Because the areas that we hunt, kind of going, circling back to how we started this conversation, the areas that we hunt get a pile of pressure in early November.
Right.
And in late October, you're not dealing with near as many people because everybody's waiting to take their rut vacation. So that's a huge plus. The bucks are also getting ramped up for the rut. However, they're not traveling super far yet. So if you've been doing any amount of scouting through the early to middle part of October, a lot of those pieces that you've been putting together can be super useful that last week. Because if those bucks are likely still in those same areas,
right,
or not far from them. So you can use all of that data that you've been acquiring the whole month of October to your advantage at the very end of the month. But as soon as the pressure shows up in early November and a few does start coming into heat, every day of November, the odds of you seeing those same bucks goes down. Now, you could see different bucks. You could see the same bucks. I mean, hard to say. I mean, one area could have 10 does in it and five of them come in heat before the fifth. That area is just going to be bonkers. You know, then down the road a mile away where the guy's saying, well, you know, they're not rutting here this year or whatever. All the does on that property may come in after the 15th.
Right.
And that hunter on that property may have hunted the first 2 weeks of November and not seen hardly anything. Right. So Once the rut rolls around and those does are actually coming into heat in November, then that throws them things in a blender. But man, late October, they're still kind of predictable. And I love hunting scrapes during that time of the year. Just from a bow hunting standpoint, I think a scrape is just really hard to beat. Maybe a small water hole or something like that, or a tight crossing, but a scrape is really great for bow hunting because it gets the buck to stop. It's a spot you can put the deer on a spot. Right. We talk about doing this often with turkeys, but with deer hunting, it's more difficult. However, when you're hunting a scrape, you can manipulate that situation a little bit on public land. So you can get set up where you need to get a good 15, 20 yard opportunity at that scrape. And then you can allow the buck to come into it, almost wait for him to start working it. And then that gives you ample opportunity to draw back, to pick your shot. And I just have noticed that the killing opportunities over scrapes for big bucks is just really good with a bow, just because you're putting them on a spot like that.
Yeah. And just anecdotally speaking, you're that last week of October, you're starting to see bucks on trail camera hitting scrapes during the daylight more often. Is that true?
Yeah. Yep. They're starting to make those rut loops a little bit, but it's, I mean, every buck is a little bit different. They all got unique personalities, but it sure seems like they kind of start just getting wider and wider and wider as it gets into the rut with their daylight loops. They make it just a little bit further as it's getting into the end of the month. So, you know, and their scraping activity is picking up because their testosterone is ramping up. So you can find, you know, around the 25th, 26th October, you can find some super fresh scrape lines that were just laid down, you know, night before.
That's right.
So if you're scouting middle of the day, you can cut sign that is super fresh and you can follow it back and figure those deer out a lot more. I mean, anytime you're running into aggressive dominant bucks that are leaving a lot of sign, those are the easiest ones to get on.
Right.
And some of those deer don't leave a lot of sign earlier in the season, especially if they don't have a lot of other competition around.
Hmm.
But as it gets closer towards the rut, in the latter part of October, they're going to start ripping things up. And that's when it becomes easier to read sign. Like I said, you don't have as many people that you're dealing with. You're putting all of those pieces that you've learned the whole month to use. And that's when we get a lot of opportunities.
See, now I can't tell if this is all just a move. You know, like Aaron says, hunt the last week of October, and everyone changes their rut vacation to the last week of October, and now all of a sudden the first week of November is nice and clear.
If they do, then I'm going to be hunting the first week of November. Yeah, because that's the number one thing. Yeah. When they're out there, it can serve to your advantage, though. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm not going hunting during that time. My options are just way more limited because there's people there. So I'm not fooling with spots where there's lots of people, or I'm trying to figure out where they're going and then look for that little hole in there where they're not.
Do you think, I mean, this is same topic, but maybe changing a little bit here. Do you think that, just really generally speaking, do you think that public land deer hunting has gotten more challenging over the years? Like just recent years?
I don't think so necessarily. I definitely have noticed more pressure in some states during certain times of the year, but there's also so much opportunity, especially for whitetails to hunt them. Most of the archery seasons in these states are open early and they last until after Christmas. And, you know, the added pressure to a degree helps you because it eliminates a lot of the guesswork out of it. At least it does for me. So if you go into a public area and it's several thousand acres in size and you don't have much experience with it, I mean, it could take years and years and years to learn that whole area.
Yeah.
And you don't have much experience with that area. The quickest way to get on deer is to look at the people and what they're doing.
Yeah.
So if 90% of it is flooded with hunters, that discourages anybody else that shows up. They're just going to show up and say, oh, well, there's just hunters everywhere. I'm not going. But what we'll do is we'll just keep moving until we find the spot, the 10% in there where there is no hunters. And then you end up finding 90% of the deer right there because there's no hunters right there. So we've had numerous examples where the pressure really helped us. where if it would be really daunting without it, because you've got this giant new area that the deer are seemingly perfectly safe in the majority of it. So they're spread out all over the landscape, and you just got to kind of pick it apart slowly but surely. But the hunting pressure is just way easier and way faster to predict than the deer themselves.
Yeah.
So that's why that's my number one thing that I'm always looking at. And then with that said, you know, we've noticed an uptick in pressure, but like I said about the opportunity thing, everybody takes their vacation in the rut, and then they go to these places and they see all these people and they're like, oh man, public land's overrun. It's ridiculous. Well, no, it's overrun when you're there.
Right.
You know, the archery season's 3 months long and everybody takes their vacations in these 1 to 2 week periods.
Right.
If you were there 2 weeks before that, you'd have had the run of the place. If you were there 2 weeks after that, there'd be very few people in there, or even the very end of the season, there's nobody out there.
Right.
And there's gobs of opportunity to do well during that time. I mean, we've killed the majority of the bucks in Iowa in the last few years in October. Yeah. And then everybody shows up in November to hunt. I mean, right. Iowa public land in November, early archery season, it has a lot of pressure on it. Always, because that's when the residents and the non-residents that drew tags, that's when they're taking their vacations. Consequently, you know, if you go down to Missouri, the last week of bow season gets a decent amount of pressure, but not ridiculous, because it's leading up to the rifle season.
Right. Everyone's taking their vacation for gun season. So most people are not doing the bow season week off.
Right.
Yeah. I think one thing that is harder to put your finger on, but I think is very true about your whole crew, just, you know, watching your guys' content, is that everyone just has a very good attitude. I think it's hard for a lot of people when they're seeing lots of other hunters and they have to do what you just described of just keep moving, you know. That's hard to do, especially when you had a spot that you kind of had in mind and you had these ideas about how you're going to hunt it. And all of a sudden now there's four other guys in there and you have to kind of go back to the drawing board. I think it can be hard for people to not get discouraged and let that experience kind of taint their hunt. But you guys have seemed like you just keep rolling with it. So can you just talk about the attitude side of it and how you're able to just not let other hunting pressure kind of get you down and not ruin your hunt and, you know, not just kind of create this like snowball effect of, we kind of lost this spot and now everything's going bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, we try to always have that attitude, no matter what it is, whether it's deer or turkeys or whatever, because, I mean, you kind of laid out a lot of the reasons right there. Why? It just, you can't kill them if you leave. Yeah. And if your goal is to have success, then that's great. But manage your expectations. Go into it with realistic expectations, knowing that you're going to deal with other people. I mean, it's public land or it's private land that you share with other people. And right. once you realize that and you stop putting so much pressure on, you know, trying to kill a specific deer off of it or whatever, then it becomes a lot more relaxed situation, where you're just going out there to try to get away from the grind of your everyday life and to have a good experience hunting. I mean, that's why we all started hunting in the first place when we were young. I mean, at least that's how I was. You know, I was brought up in a deer camp culture in Missouri, and everybody would get together and, you know, stay the night at deer camp and then come back to the buck pole in the middle of the day and see who got what and hang around a campfire and talk deer hunting. That was just as important as the hunt itself. And that's why we always have a pretty good attitude, because number one, we like hunting with each other and spending time with each other, but also because we know that there's a lot of folks out there that will give up, that they'll have a poor attitude, and that will then in turn affect the effort that they're able to put in.
Yeah,
because it's true, man. I mean, when you start getting the doubts creeping in and you start thinking like, oh man, this place is awful, I just want to go home, you know, there's too many people out here, blah, blah, blah. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to scout and hunt harder, or are you going to give up? And consequently, most people just give up. And some people may not ever go back to that area ever again. So that's just an opportunity for us to continue having positive experiences out there. And I mean, Georgia was a good example from a few years ago where we went and we hunted, and we knew it was going to be like really difficult.
Right.
Big woods scenario, public land in the Southeast is not easy.
Just for folks who like don't follow along always with THP, like you didn't have to go to Georgia. You picked it, right? Like this is like part of the concept of your program.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like we want to challenge ourselves because we got viewers from Georgia messaging us saying, well, how do we deal with these deer down here where everything's a bedding area? Everything's a thicket. You know, our deer in the Southeast are different than the deer in the Midwest. Well, yes and no, they are. But I can't tell somebody, you know, if I'm sitting in Iowa hunting, and somebody asked me a question about hunting deer in Florida or Georgia, I can't intelligently even begin to answer their question because I have never hunted there until recently. I want to be able to try to help those people with something, you know, if they're watching our program and trying to find value in it somehow, the best way we can create value for them is by putting ourselves in their shoes.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And when we went down there, we had expectations were low. It was like, let's just see a deer first. And then if we see a deer, maybe we'll get a shot at a deer, period. This with a muzzleloader, not even with a bow. So going into it, it was like, man, if we even saw a deer when we went out and found any deer sign, we were just giddy. We were super excited because we didn't know what to expect. We knew, but we set our expectations pretty low, and it blew everything out of the water that we ever expected to happen. I mean, we ended up getting a hog and 2 bucks.
Nice.
And it was a really fun trip. But I think that's where some people get tripped up. You know, a lot of folks take Iowa for example, and they wait 4 or 5 years to draw a tag and spend all this money and time into this hunt. Yep. And then they get to Iowa and they set their expectations on like 150 or 160 inch buck with a bow on public land. And then they hunt real hard for 2 weeks and they get frustrated because they're having a hard time meeting their goal or meeting their expectations.
That's right.
Well, it's just managing those in some way so that you can still enjoy hunting. I think, you know, hunting in my eyes isn't meant to be super competitive. I'm all fine with being competitive on things, you know, sports and stuff like that, or whatever it is that you're doing in life. But we're killing animals, man. We're killing animals to eat, number one.
Yeah.
And we're sharing time with family and friends.
Yeah.
And trying to, you know, get closer to nature and the earth as best as we can and understand these things. The competition aspect of it drives people to get really serious about it. And then that in turn makes them, you know, not want to work with other hunters as much. That forces them to be more, you know, solo mindset. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that's the way you want to skin the cat, go ahead. I mean, that's the good thing about hunting is there's a bunch of different ways to do it. But those are also the folks that I see that get disappointed more often because they're setting their goal on a number of inches or age of a deer or something like that. When, you know, why did you get involved in hunting in the first place? I would challenge anybody that hunts like that to really think about, well, how'd you get started in this? It wasn't to try to beat somebody else, or it wasn't to try to meet a number. It was 99% of the time, it was grassroots. You got started hunting and you really enjoyed it, so you kept doing it. You know, it was deer camps and fork horns and all that. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, I know, but that's one reason why we're pretty optimistic all the time, and the camaraderie is a big aspect of what we do.
Yeah, no, I like so much about what you just said. And I think, you know, even for the folks who are very success driven, you know, let's, like, whether that be right or wrong, you and I both know that there are deer hunters out there who kind of have a, you know, they base their success, their definition of success on, you know, shooting a buck, whether it be kind of a class of buck or an age class of buck. I think even for those folks, remembering the point of all of it and trying to keep that positive attitude and just kind of being able to, like, a lot of what you guys do is pretty self-deprecating. You know, we all make mistakes in the woods, and like, that's okay. It's funny. Like being able to kind of laugh at yourself and your own mistakes. Like, I think that will make you more successful on killing big bucks too. Because you're going to just stay lighter and just have, like, you're going to be able to hang in there longer. I think like that's a much more sustainable attitude, even if deep down, like, your goal is to kill a big one. So yeah, I mean, for most of us, it should be about just the experience and having fun and being with our buddies. But even for those folks who are really success driven, like, I think they can find some helpful information in what you just laid out there.
I hope so. I mean, we definitely started having more success when the goal just became learning over anything else. Is like, okay, what can we learn today? Yeah. What can we learn about this area? What can we learn about, you know, our hunting, our weapon setup? What can we learn about this deer that we're chasing? Anything. And that just compounds itself. It's like a snowball effect.
Yeah.
And the more you're able to, the more information you're able to bring in and stay positive with, the more success you'll ultimately have. That's what we've found. So I would echo what you just said.
Yeah. Okay. This is my last question for you. You know, with all the good digital mapping applications out there, you know, states doing a much better job of kind of displaying and showing their public lands and their public hunting land specifically. Do you think that the idea of a secret spot, like a secret deer hunting spot, does that still exist? Or are there no secret spots left out there?
You mean on public land?
Yep.
No, there's definitely still secret spots out there. But for the most part, what we found is there's people that go all over the public areas that we hunt. I mean, most of the time in a given year, there will be somebody on just about every acre or two of it at some point or another. But there's definitely areas where people frequent less that you find more deer in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. As far as a secret spot goes, I don't know that we've ever found anything like that. I mean, there's been a few spots that were really, really good to us for 2 or 3 years in a row where there was just an absence of people and lots of deer, but then that changed and then there was a bunch of people in there. However, fast forward a couple years later and their people aren't there anymore and the bucks are back.
Yeah.
So I think they're still out there, but I just think they change, you know, where a lot of people believe they've got a little honey hole or a little secret spot that if it's on public land, it's going to change.
Yeah.
It's public. I mean, somebody's going to end up in there at some point in time. But just as soon as they ended up in there, they can leave.
Yeah.
And that's what I've noticed is, man, if a spot gets a bunch of press or something like that, and there's a lot of people that end up there for whatever reason, or a big buck is spotted out there and it attracts everybody from town, and they start hunting the crap out of it, well, the deer get onto that.
Right.
They don't know what the difference in public and private is. They just know, like, when people show up, we need to leave.
Yeah.
So, and they're not going to leave the area completely, but they're definitely going to change how they behave, and they're going to make it more difficult for you to get a shot at them. And when that happens, you know, you see an increase of people, then you see the success drop, and then the people start leaving. And then you see the bucks and the deer, or deer in general, come back, and then you see the success go up, and then you see the people come back in, and it's just this ebb and flow thing.
It's like you basically just described the predator prey cycle, but yep. in terms of hunting pressure.
So, exactly.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. And I think that is totally true. You know, like I've seen it myself on the turkey hunting side, where there will just be this perfect spot that no one ever seems to hunt. And then I'll kill turkeys there happily every year, or shoot a couple out of there every year. And then all of a sudden, for whatever reason, the next year there, it's just covered up with trucks and hunters. But then if I'm, patient and kind of keep that good attitude of what you're talking about, there's not all those people just a mile down the road, you know? And I think, we're just, you know, we're kind of habitual creatures just like the deer are. And we maybe don't recognize it, but we kind of go in these, cycles and waves too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And if you've got, you know, to your example about the turkey hunting, with turkey or deer, we see the same thing. If you have five or six decent spots on a particular area that you have learned because you've just been out there gaining experience, and you've been more focused on that aspect of it than just the harvest itself, then you can adapt and adjust accordingly.
Yeah.
You know, if you only have one secret spot that you kill two or three animals out of, and then all of a sudden there's a bunch of people in there, and you throw up your hands and say, oh, the public's full of people, and you go home and you quit hunting. Well, then, I mean, what'd you expect was going to happen? You only had one spot. You know, if you had five of them and you could
one
just
of them
bounce,
going to be good. Yeah.
Yeah. If you bounce to option B, C, D, E, there's a good chance one of them's going to be good. I mean, we've done that with deer and turkeys both. Where, you know, a guy will kill a deer one year in a spot, and then they'll tell us where they killed it at, and it'll be like, man, there's always people in there. And then they'll say, well, there wasn't anybody in there when I went in there.
Yeah.
And there was bucks in there, and I got one. So
yeah.
It's good to keep your options open. Every year is different. I mean, the playing field gets reset even multiple times throughout a given deer season. Every couple weeks is different.
All right, Aaron, that was really useful information, and I'm feeling pretty good. Maybe I'll do some public land hunting this year. Maybe I'll do it late season after everybody's rut vacation is over.
There you go. Might be surprised what you find.
Podcast is edited and produced by me, executive editor Natalie Krebs. It's hosted by our editor-in-chief, Alex Robinson. Music in this episode was composed and performed by Jennifer Jordan and Eric Starksan via APM Music. For more deer hunting tips and insight, tune into this podcast next week for another episode brought to you by Moultrie Mobile Edge Pro.